Good morning, everyone. I'm Daniel Bond, and I'm the treasurer of East Shore. Welcome to our church this morning. I want to start with an introduction of our guest musician, Karen Tooley. Karen ran into some traffic difficulties getting here this morning, and she performed what you just heard, cold. Many of us know Karen as the pianist at our sibling congregation, the Unitarian Universalist Society of Cleveland. She also accompanies Windsong, Cleveland's feminine chorus. Karen has a Bachelor of Music in Piano Performance from the Cleveland Institute of Music and has accompanied ballet and modern dance at notable organizations like Mather Dance Center at Case, the Jacquetti Council of America Summer Dance Intensive, Cleveland City Dance, and Cleveland School of Dance, among many others. Her original scores include numerous small pieces for student productions at local schools, as well as the 75-minute An Urban Nutcracker, a modern street version of the tale, which received national attention in Time Magazine and the Wall Street Journal. I'd like to extend a special welcome to those of us who are here with us this morning as newcomers, and I'd like to encourage you to get a chance to know us a bit. If you'd like to be on our mailing list, we invite you to sign up at the greeters table in the narthex. There's also information at the pamphlet rack in the narthex. And please join us for polite conversation in the back of the sanctuary following the service. Most of it you'll find to be polite. If you haven't already done so, please turn off your little noisemakers, at least silence them, and check your order of service for announcements and calendar information. There also might be some information that interests you on the newsstand, which is at the back of the sanctuary. Now, sharing the words of Lila Ibrahim, "It is a blessing you were born. It matters what you do with your life. What you know about God is a piece of the truth. You do not have to do it alone. Now, may we journey together in our shared worship. Thank you."
Last week we sang "Love Will Guide Us" at the end of our service. And while the guest accompanist, Pam Shank, played it beautifully, it was really slow. It was reflective, almost a meditation. So this morning I asked Karen to really knock it out of the park and really rock it.
She will.
So let's please rise now as you're willing and able and open your gray hymnal to number 131, "Love Will Guide Us."
Thank you.
As you settle into this space, this nurturing, embracing semicircle beneath this beacon that shines down upon us as we shine our light out in the world through it, I'd like to welcome you here with an invitation to transformation, an invitation to move toward a vision of a new world, with the words of Frederick Boehner. Listen to your life. See it for the fathomless mystery that it is. In the boredom and pain of it, no less than in the excitement and gladness. Touch, taste, smell your way into the hidden holy heart of it. Because in the last analysis, all moments are key moments, and life itself is grace. May this time, may this place be filled with the grace that allows us to transform ourselves and each other.
We light our chalice this morning with the words of Reverend Joe Cherry, a prayer for living intention. If we have any hope of transforming the world and ourselves, we must be bold enough to step into our discomfort, brave enough to be clumsy there, loving enough to forgive ourselves and each other. As we light this chalice, may we, as a people of faith, be granted the strength to be so bold, so brave, so loving.
As you came into the sanctuary this morning, I hope you remembered to take a stone from the bamboo bowl out in the narthex next to the Book of Joys and Cares. If you would like one for the Joys and Cares rituals, if you missed one, Barbara, could you? Does anybody need one? Cool, okay. Barbara will bring one to you. So the stones in this bowl, as I told you last week, came from the Chagrin River nearby. I'm going to invite you to hold on tightly to the stone in your hand during our time of silence so that you can infuse your stone with all of your joys and cares, the intentions with which we've lit candles in the past. Now, the stone can be a container for your joys and cares, or perhaps the simple act of doing something together intentionally can be the vehicle for your joys and cares. You can think of this as a profoundly spiritual practice so that the stone is a manifestation of your prayer for everyone and everything that matters to you. And if that doesn't feel authentic, you might think of this as a gesture symbolizing your hopes for your loved ones and for the world. You may come up and put your stone into the bowl in the center on our altar, or you may keep it for the week and put it on your altar at home, or put it in your garden. You may carry it with you all week and put it in this bowl next week. You may just put it back into the bamboo bowl in the narthex on your way out. You may be an active participant or a passive observer. It's all good. So now I invite you to hold on to your stone as tightly or as gently as you like, as we share from our book. Reggie Comar wrote that she spoke with Dee Beecham this week. Dee is doing well following her knee replacement surgery September 4th. She enjoys receiving cards and hopes to become more active soon. Somebody writes that voter registration is available during coffee hour. This is a really good thing. And if you go out there and check with, I'm guessing it's Lynn.
She's teaching at the moment.
Okay, she will be able to check for you to see if you're registered. So how cool is that? Tim Ray writes, to please keep John Opie in your thoughts. After a wonderful 8-day trip to Moab, with family and hospice support, he's now home and continues his... I'm having a hard time reading this. But anyways, he continues with sort of living with Parkinson's disease. So his wife Barb and Tim and all of the family are supportive of his wishes at this point. Dick Jackson continues to struggle to breathe in the neurointensive care unit at University Hospital. He's intubated, he's very uncomfortable, and he can't communicate, so he's not in a position to greet guests. His wife, Diana, asks simply that we all be on their side. She knows she's going to need everybody's accompaniment soon, but for right now, they just need this time alone together. We pause in solidarity with everyone affected by Hurricane Florence. The displaced humans and animals, the 12 dead and hundreds injured, the first responders and heroic neighbors, all of whom have come to be the symbols for how we can be together in times of crisis. May we all be transformed into our best by the examples set by others and mindful of them as they prepare for a catastrophic day of flooding expected today. For these and all the joys and cares that remain unspoken, we observe a moment of silent meditation. And now I invite you to come forward and place your stones into the bowl. And I'd like to ask you to come down the center aisle and then go back to your seat on the outside. So please, come forward now.
Our reading this morning is from a speech by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That has become known as I Have a Dream. It was delivered at the March on Washington, D.C. on August 28, 1963. We have come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quick sands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until there is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to the business as usual.
The Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur begins at sundown on Tuesday. Yom Kippur is the highest of holy days for Jews, a day in which adults fast and atone for their sins, their personal sins, their communal sins. Sarah Barash Hagens is a rabbi affiliated with Rabbis Without Borders. She's part of the Reconstructionist tradition of Judaism, which, it may surprise you to learn, is so similar to Unitarian Universalism that for a while, back in the 1970s, the two were talking about merging into one faith. The sticking point was what the name of that new faith would be. The merger never happened. Rabbi Barash Hagens offers this racial justice prayer this year for Yom Kippur. I share it with you this morning, knowing that the God described in the prayer is not a God that most of us believe in, but it's offered in a spirit of seeking to understand the faith experiences of those whose work in the world is so closely related to our own. Adonai, for the racism we allowed because we felt compelled by fears for our safety if we acted, and for the racism we allowed willingly with no justification offered. For the racist statements we said in private and for the coded language we said in public. For the racism committed accidentally and for the racism committed intentionally. For the racism that we allowed by failing to take proactive steps to end oppression. And for the racism that we allowed by failing to speak up after violence was perpetrated. For the racism we committed through our actions, and for the racism we committed through our inaction. For our racism of which we are conscious, and for the racism that lives in our subconscious. We've already told you of our racism that we have the awareness to recognize, and you have already known of our racism that we still cannot see. As it is said, Adonai, our God, knows all that is difficult for us to see and what is clear to us and to our children forever, to do all these mitzvot in the Torah. And David, your servant, said before you, I cannot understand all of my mistakes. Please cleanse me of the sins in my subconscious. God, you are merciful, and receive those seeking to become allies. From the beginning, you have promised us that we could do teshuva. So we plead with you to accept our return, that for all the people who commit to justice and to leaving their racism in the past, you will forgive them so that they may keep turning inward and outward and always toward truth.
I just realized the last page is missing. So hopefully Rev Denis will have it by the time I get there. I grew up in Cleveland Heights in the 1940s and 50s in an atmosphere of benevolent white privilege. My mother would not tolerate overt racism by pointing out things not to do or say when we were exposed to racist remarks or actions of others. On the other hand, my exposure to minorities was primarily through occasional domestic help. They were always called by their first name, like Savannah or Pearl, but treated respectfully with appreciation. Mom would serve them a hearty lunch at the table with the family. As a young adult, I took a class in 1970 at the University of Pittsburgh from a black professor who could have been a clone of Barack Obama on the sociology of race relations. He explained how the police in Pittsburgh isolated the black communities from one another after the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1963. 1968, which prevented riots in that city, this class raised my awareness of racism, and I became fascinated by its role in our history and culture. I soon began to recognize examples I had not noticed before in my everyday life. As I continued my pursuit of an MA in history at Cleveland State, I was given permission to take a seminar class in American Black Literature in 1963. When I arrived the first day, the professor was standing in the middle of a common area, handing out the syllabus to about a dozen students, diverse in age, sex, and race. He was a very large and very black man with a bushy beard, wearing a dashiki and sandals. He did not even assemble the group or have us sit down together. He just provided the assignments and scheduled our first discussion. His parting words were, "By the way, I just want you all to know I hate white people." Stunned, I walked away anguishing over how could I possibly get an A in this class. I needed an A. I was dropped into a world I never imagined, an authentic American world, totally alien to my own. Black American literature vividly took me there by intense reading of authors like James Baldwin, Richard Wright, Eldridge Cleaver, and Malcolm X, as well as Booker T. Washington and Martin Luther King. Lively discussions stretched my vision further twice a week. By the time I finished this class, I knew racism was the responsibility of my white American community. I asked my professor, who had claimed to hate me that first day, what I could do to help. He emphatically stated I needed to work within my white community. I have spent the last 40-plus years working on this as I had the opportunity. I created and taught a class in White Bay Village High School for 10 years on African American history. Being a hands-on aunt to my 6 biracial nieces and nephews, which included defending my sister's choices to the rest of my family, going out of my way to be kind and welcoming to members of the black community, as well as expressing my disagreement with racist comments made by friends and family. This has been the most difficult of all these efforts. I thought I had rid myself of the scourge of white privilege. This spring, coming home from Florida to Ohio, I stopped in South Atlanta for the night. I picked a modest motel that did not charge much extra for my cat. After all, I was just stopping for the night and leaving first thing the next morning. The young woman at the desk was white, with many tattoos, piercings, and purple hair. She told me to take the key to check out the room to see if I wanted to stay there. I had never experienced that kind of offer and became wary, but went along with it. As I walked to the room, I realized she was the last white person I was to see there. The room seemed fine after I passed a number of people hanging around in a friendly, casual way. They did notice me, however, as I walked by them in the parking lot. I had a little talking to myself as I checked the room. So this is how they feel all their life as they navigate my white world. I had resolved to walk the walk of my frequent talk all these years. Everything went fine for the next 12 hours or so, and I became a better person. This work is harder than I thought, but I do believe it is worth it. This opportunity offered us UUs to be on the leading edge in this country to rid it of white racism is an exciting challenge. I do think that America will rid itself of what has been called our original sin when we reach a critical mass of white Americans who will not tolerate the bigotry that occurs around us. This is my vision of our country, and we UUs can help lead the way.
Hartford, Connecticut in 1966 looked the way a lot of cities in the United States did back then, with expansion in the defense industry around World War II. There were basically two kinds of people in Hartford at that time, and none of them were particularly rich. There were African Americans and other black people, and there were recent immigrants. And some people fell into both categories. And pretty much everyone lived in a neighborhood surrounded by people like themselves. Most centered around a house of worship. Cities, to varying degrees, were in turmoil, still reeling from the Brown versus Board of Education decision 12 years earlier that required desegregation of public schools. White flight was in full swing. My parents were pretty unaware of white flight. If they did see what was going on, they didn't completely understand it. They had just come from Quebec, Canada, where just about everybody was white, where the social hierarchy had more to do with religion and language than with skin color. The only thing they knew of black folks when they moved to Hartford was the story my great aunt had told them about her convent's mission trip to southern states in the early 60s. The shock and horror of seeing separate and very unequal public accommodations like restrooms, hotels, and restaurants. We lived on Zion Street in the Roman Catholic parish of St. Anne's, where every single mass was offered in French. When I was a year old, we moved to the working class suburb of Enfield, not to get away from black people, but to have a little house with a little yard my brother and I could play in. My parents wanted a piece of the pie that they came here for. They worked hard for that down payment and had no idea they were being given a privilege that black Americans didn't get, an FHA-subsidized loan outside of a redlined district. My parents worked hard to give me an incredible gift. They sent me to a world-class private art school, Rhode Island School of Design in Providence, where I made friends with people from New York, Singapore, Bangkok, Johannesburg, London, and Vancouver. Providence was an incredible place to be then, at least for me. The East Side neighborhood where Brown University and RISD intertwined had an international feel to it. I shared spaces with the children of people like Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter and Paul McCartney. The whole city was the most diverse place I'd ever seen, a daily cacophony of languages and music. Any day of the week, I could be in my car at a red light and hear the world coming through a variety of radios. Except on Sunday. Something amazing happened every Sunday. WBRU, the Brown University radio station, aired an all-day program called the 360-Degree Black Experience in Sound. All day long, they played Denise Williams, Miles Davis, Eartha Kitt, Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin, and Cameo. On Sunday, everywhere you went, everyone was tuned to WBRU. On the streets, there were so many speakers pumping out WBRU that it was like the biggest R&B concert you'd ever been to. Every single Sunday. The only thing I never understood about it was the name. It felt to me like a 180-degree experience in which a whole lot of white people got to venture into a world that they didn't usually get access to. For that one day, the minority got to dominate. It seemed to me then like we all got to do an about-face and move in the same direction. In my third year at school, I did the opposite of what my parents did and bought a house in the inner city, in the neighborhood of South Providence, a fixer-upper that barely fit on its tiny urban lot. I spent two consecutive summers listening to WBRU on Sundays, stripping 100 years' worth of wallpaper, skim coating, and painting to the beat of cameos, back, back, forth, forth, back, back, forth, forth. It was a funny house. It was built in 1901. The exterior still in the colonial revival style of the Victorian era, with Ionic columns and decorative urns and balustraded balconies. But inside, it was like three little 1950s suburban ranch houses stacked one on top of the other. It had been stripped of detail, optimistically modernized, just before Brown versus Board of Ed, its owners completely unaware of what was to come. By the time I moved in, it was a mess. And within a year after that, there were three of us living in those apartments, and we were the only white people on our street. It was also a funny neighborhood. Now, funny isn't exactly the right word. It was tragic. The schools were terrible. The hospitals turned people away. There were no grocery stores, only liquor stores that sold fast food, lottery tickets. Every block, including ours, had at least one crack house and one abandoned house used on Sundays by people from the suburbs to illegally dump unwanted mattresses and fake leather couches. When you stop next to those folks at red lights, they were the ones not listening to the 360-degree black experience and sound. Their windows were up, their doors were locked. They just wanted to dump their junk and get out. The thing that made the neighborhood hardest to live in, though, were the guests. In those days, before cell phones, they'd call me before leaving home to let me know their estimated time of arrival so that I could be out front waiting at the gate so they could pull right in and escort them into the house. So right on schedule, I graduated from RISD. I was tired of the sirens and the noise, and I moved to the edge of a quiet town in western Massachusetts, where I was an outsider because I couldn't afford membership to either of the country clubs. It was isolating, depressing, despite the manicured lawns and the fresh faces. One Sunday, I was walking my dogs, being ignored by everyone I passed, and I realized why that WBRU program was called the 360-degree black experience in sound and not the 180-degree black experience. It may have given me what felt like full immersion in a black experience of music, the same way it felt like a full immersion experience to live in that black neighborhood. I was introduced to Miles, Eartha, and Stevie over the air the way I got to know Charlene and Money and Johnny and Mrs. Whetstone on the sidewalks. But on Monday, I went back to NPR for the rest of the week. And at the end of my 2 years in South Providence, I went back to the suburbs. Both were 360-degree experiences. I went right back to where I had been before, unchanged. I was unchanged by South Providence, and South Providence was unchanged by me. Actually, though, South Providence was changed by me. I fixed up that old colonial revival and sold it to another white buyer. I was a gentrifier. And I was changed by South Providence because it forced me to see something that changed me. I saw firsthand the injustice of a system that allows people to use predominantly black neighborhoods as dumping grounds for garbage, chemicals, air pollution, and even crime. A system that targets the poor disproportionately as a market for tobacco, alcohol, and lottery tickets. And as a student of architecture and urban design while I lived there, I learned the history of zoning, lending, and transportation planning that drew lines around black neighborhoods as containment zones. I learned that I had choices about where I could go, choices that weren't available to everyone. So I was changed. I wasn't changed 180 degrees, but maybe a degree or two. Maybe my time in South Providence was a 358-degree black experience, if I'm lucky. But it's been 30 years since I left. The world is different. And the way we talk about everything from race to gender to sexuality to poverty to policing has changed. Tarana Burke got men thinking about how men treat women and their own role in violence. Colin Kaepernick got white people thinking about how black folks experience this nation differently from white folks and others. Reverend King gave his I Have a Dream speech 3 months before Jack Kennedy was assassinated and 5 years before King himself was killed. The nation's cities seemed to erupt overnight into fiery protests of things never changing. Neighborhoods like South Providence were destroyed. That's when the grocery stores left and the desolation began. The nation returned to business as usual, and the rude awakening has come, but probably not as King imagined. It's come in quiet protest, an anger overtaking the knee. Mary Mason, I wonder if you could share with us the poem you shared with the seventh principal group on Thursday. Now, this poem is by Andrew Freeborg, a U.S. Army veteran who ran for the Oregon legislature as a libertarian.
I stand to honor the promise the flag represents. You kneel because that promise has been broken. I stand to affirm my belief that all are created equal and to fight alongside you for that promise. You kneel because too few stand with you. I stand because we can be better. You kneel to remind us to be better. I stand to honor all that have fought and died so that we may be free. You kneel because not all of us are. I stand because I can. You kneel for those who can't. I stand to defend your right to kneel. You kneel to defend my right to stand. I stand because I love this country. You kneel because you love it too.
There's something really moving to me about this poem. It conveys the understanding that there are differences that elicit different reactions in us, that we interpret symbols differently based on our experience. The poem seems to say, I understand your peaceful protest. And I might be reading too much into this, but it seems to say, I've been changed by it. Even if Mr. Freeborg wasn't changed by the protest, he's clearly trying to change the minds of others. And change is happening, even if it's small change, 2-degree change, like the one that took more than 2 years to happen in me. I can't change having made money in South Providence or retreating to the suburb afterward. And though I wouldn't do it again, I don't feel shame or guilt for what I did. I did what I could with the resources and knowledge I had at the time. I learned something in the process, in relationship with my neighbor, even if it was never much more than chatting over the fence as we all shared the same Sunday radio experience. If I had to do it over again, I'd be more a part of the neighborhood. I'd invite people into my home. I'd show up at local events. But the memory of that time in that neighborhood made me very sympathetic. The first time I heard of Colin Kaepernick taking the knee. And for that, I'm really grateful. I find myself wondering what it will take for all of us to change. I know we can't all change 180 degrees because we can't undo the lives that has made us who we are at this moment. We can't erase history. We can't change the color of our skin any more than we can change other people's prejudices about us, whether they're positive or negative. But we can be in relationship with our neighbors. We can invite them in and show up for their events. And in places like Kirtland, places where virtually everybody seems the same, we can expand our definition of neighbor to include everybody, from Mentor to Ashtabula to Collinwood. It's the only way, I think, that we can fulfill Reverend King's dream that he described as deeply rooted in the American dream. His dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of the creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Whether we rise to honor the promise of the flag, the promise the flag represents, or we kneel because that promise has been broken. You know, during the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, the words to many black spirituals were changed to indicate unity and cohesion. So "I shall overcome" became "we shall overcome." But in early spirituals sung by enslaved people as they worked and worshiped, "I" was never meant to signify only one person, not only the singer, but instead to mean everyone who has ever been oppressed and sings the song. As "We Shall Overcome" was adapted and set to a different tune named for Martin Luther King, it was meant to include white folks and others who haven't known the black experience. And still, there's often a feeling that white people who haven't known the same kind of oppression don't have the right to sing "We Shall Overcome." So I invite you this morning to sing this song reflectively, meditatively, aware that we all have different experiences and that the thing most of us, dare I say all of us, want to overcome is our fear of the other. Our long history of only dipping our toes into the lives of those different from ourselves, only to return to our unknowing. I invite us to sing this, hoping to have something less than a 360-degree experience. So please rise now, as you're willing or able, in body or in spirit, and open your gray hymnal to number 169, "We Shall Overcome."
Thank you.
More than 50 years ago, Reverend King said that the most segregated hour in America is 11 o'clock on Sunday. And it's still true. The majority of Unitarian Universalist congregations across the country, like East Shore, are overwhelmingly white. We may have a few people of color, people who are Latinx, Native American, Roma, Asian, or Middle Eastern. Often, they're assumed to be white because of the paleness of their skin, their levels of education or wealth, or the race of their spouses and children. But black folks in our congregations rarely blend in. And so often, one person or one nuclear family may be the only one among us. And usually they have to hear ad nauseum about how much we want to be more diverse and how it's not happening and how we struggle with our liberal guilt. Every single Sunday is a 360-degree white experience for many Unitarian Universalists of color. And that's why Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism is asking East Shore for $1,570 this month, which represents $10 per adult member. They need the money to help create change by sending people around the country to speak to our congregations about their experience as black religious liberals. They need the money to support paid positions within our association so that they can do this intense work and still make a modest living. They need the money to provide the kind of programming that will help us all change together to live out our vision of the American dream. As Joan said to me earlier this week, BLUU wants more than just money. They want partners in making justice. And the way we can begin to be partners is by sharing a bit of what we have. So that's why this month, in addition to my regular pledge of 5% of my gross income, I'm giving an additional $10 a week to Blue. Now, I know there are folks who simply can't afford to give a bit extra, and I want to cover them as well as myself, and I want to encourage you to do the same if you can. If you want to give this to this special collection, please make your check out to Blue, BLUU, and write make the check out to East Shore and write BLUU in the memo line. Or you can put it into the white envelope and write BLUU on the front. What the people of Black Lives of UU is asking us to do is to enter into this work with them joyfully, generously, meeting each other in a place not just of commonality, but in willingness to maybe see what it's like for a little bit, in some way, to share some of our power, to share some of our lives. This morning's offering will now be accepted, and if you're visiting for the first time, please let the collection basket pass you as our guest. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Your Board of Trustees, your Finance Committee, and the officers charged with responsibility to keep track of the money and make sure it gets spent for properly and accounted for properly, all appreciate your generosity and your decisions to support this church. Thank you.
We close our worship this morning with the words of Rainer Maria Rilke, translated by Stephen Mitchell. Have patience with everything unresolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language. Don't search for answers which could not be given to you now because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps then, someday, far into the future, you will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into the answer.
Thank you so much, Karin. Before we end with the Bond of Union, I just want to share with you a few announcements. Today we've got a new to UU class that's going to be focusing on theology, and we'll be meeting in the conference room just beyond the community room with the couches. On Thursday, we've got a beverages and – oh, no, I'm sorry. That's next week. On Saturday next week, we've got the East Shore Summer Fall Outing, which is going to be at Daniels Park on Johnny Cake Road in Willoughby, and you're invited to bring a picnic to share, clothes that can get wet, and a towel. Something tells me there's going to be water involved. And the following week on Thursday, we have beverages and banter. So I guess that's it for now. I'd like to invite you to rise now as you're willing and able and join hands for our Bond of Union, which is printed in our order of service, if you don't know the words. We join hands in Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, pledging ourselves to an individual religious freedom which transcends all creeds, not to think alike, but to journey together.